Good evening. My name is Magnus Bernhardsen, and it is my pleasure and honor to introduce tonight's main speakers for our plenary. Both of them are esteemed specialists in Middle Eastern history, and when at a time when we hear so much about the Middle East in popular discourses in the media, much of which is not necessarily based on realities on the ground, we thought it was very important that we bring in people who have actually conducted real research in innovative ways to talk to us about not only Iraq today, but also about thinking about America's role in the Middle East historically. The way this will happen is that they will each speak for about 25 minutes, and then we will open up the floor for sort of general discussion. The first speaker is Professor Zachary Lockman, who is a professor of Middle Eastern history and studies at New York University, and he was recently the president of the Middle East Studies Association, or MESA. He is a specialist in the socio-economic history of the region, and in many ways defined or pioneered the new social history of the Middle East. He specifically worked on Egyptian labor history, but also on Palestine. For example, I'd like to point your attention to one of his books called Comrades and Enemies, Arab and Jewish Workers in Palestine, 1906 to 1948. And then a very recent book that I actually use in my classes that I recommend to all of you to check out. It's called Contending Visions of the Middle East, the History and Politics of Orientalism, which is a very useful overview. The second speaker for tonight is Dina Hodi, who is a professor of history and international affairs at George Washington University. She is a specialist in the history of Iraq. She has been focusing on the Ottoman period, for example, in her book State and Provincial Society in the Ottoman Empire, that came out in 1997. She's now working on a project on war and remembrance in Iraq today. Professor Hodi has worked a lot in the Ottoman Empire. Like I said before, I was in a faculty reading group this year. This was comparing land-based empires. So we looked at the Mongolians and the Ottoman Empire and so on and so forth. And we picked an article by Dina Hodi for our Ottoman reading, and I really recommend her work. So first we have Professor Lockman.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Okay. It's an honor to have been invited to be with you, and it's a thrill to be among so many historians and friends of historians, and an even greater thrill to be among so many historians against the war. And Magnus's suggestion, I'm going to do a little overview, perhaps a little breathless and schematic, and if to some of you this is old hat, I'll ask you to forgive me, and hopefully some pieces of it will be a little new or a little different, and at least I'll set the stage for Dina talking about Iraq specifically. What I'd like to talk about is the role of the United States in the Middle East. In a lot of the talk about the invasion and occupation of Iraq, it's often depicted, it's often assumed, as if this somehow comes out of nowhere, as if this marks a radical break with all that came before. We certainly see this in a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the criticism, for example, by the Democratic presidential candidates, but also by much of the foreign policy establishment, by much of the media. And it's certainly true that there are elements of this project which are distinctive, right? The idea of occupying and remolding an entire Arab country and an entire region is something that had not been contemplated, at least through direct military means, by previous administrations. And of course, the level of, one could argue at least, the level of deception, the level of brutality, again, the use of this massive military power to achieve this goal, is something which has its specificities, which marks, or can be argued at least to mark, a certain degree of discontinuity. But I'll focus on the continuity part, because this did not come out of nowhere, the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And while it's easy and fun and necessary to bash the Bush administration, it's also important to remember the historical context and to locate this particular adventure, this particular project, in the six decades of U.S. involvement in this region. So I'd like to do a little sort of quick review and then get us to where we are today and then talk about some related issues very briefly, and I hope in the discussion section of this session we can address some other things. Now, this is a region in which the United States had relatively little involvement until the end of the Second World War. There were, of course, American Protestant missionaries in Lebanon and Syria from the early mid-19th century. There was, of course, a certain interest in Palestine as the Holy Land in the 19th century. There were a number of American educational institutions, what became the American University in Beirut, and others, which had a significant cultural influence at a certain stage. But essentially, for the United States, this was a region that was in the orbit of the European powers, and particularly, of course, of Britain and France, which began to encroach on the region, began to conquer and rule parts of it from the middle of the 19th century onward, a process that culminated in the division of the Arab provinces, the Ottoman Empire, at the end of the First World War. Now, in that process, the United States was actually involved as one of the victors of the First World War. But essentially, these territories were divided up among Britain and France, and the vision was that they would be the states, the outside colonial powers, which would maintain order, so to speak, maintain the status quo, and rule these regions. For the United States, the main global interests were elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere and the Pacific region. And, of course, then when the United States began acquiring an extracontinental empire, its attention was turned towards Asia, Hawaii, the Philippines, and informally in South America, the Caribbean, and so on. But by the late 1930s, and of course certainly the Second World War, but a little bit earlier with respect to one particular place, we begin to see signs of a growing American interest. And of course, unsurprisingly, this involved oil. The oil resources of the region, of course, were of increasing importance. They were largely under the control of British and French companies by virtue of the fact that the British and French dominated the region. But in the late 1930s, American oil prospectors turned up in one part of this region that had not been directly colonized. And this is, of course, Saudi Arabia, which was a new state, which had been really put together only a few years earlier, a very poor state, dependent on subsidies from the British, and then those subsidies were cut off. The ruling elites desperately needed some source of new revenue, and we're happy to have American prospectors, people from what was not seen at that point as a non-colonial power, come in and look for oil. Of course, they were soon to discover that Saudi Arabia had vast oil reserves, and these were under the control of American oil companies. The particular consortium of oil companies, the organization that was established, the company was known as Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, originally put together by Texaco and Chevron. And these reserves are today something like a quarter of global reserves, extremely high quality, extremely cheap to extract. So this was an incredible bonanza and gave the United States, through these corporate interests, and of course soon with the involvement of the government, a direct interest. Certainly by the end of the Second World War, with the United States having emerged as the preeminent global military and economic power, Saudi Arabia came to be seen as an asset of tremendous strategic importance. And in fact, the United States, and this is often forgotten as well, was crucial to constructing the modern Saudi state. You may remember that in the end of the First Gulf War in 1990-91, there was a lot of talk that this is the first time you have American troops there, this is the first time the United States is directly involved. Well, in fact, the institutions of the Saudi state that were developed in the 1940s and on into the 1950s were largely the product of interaction with U.S. consulting outfits, with the State Department, with the U.S. military, and of course there was a U.S. military base in Saudi Arabia way back in the 1950s. In fact, the Saudi national anthem was invented and first played at a hotel in New York City in the late 1940s in honor of a visit by members of the Saudi royal family. You have a state, you need a national anthem, they didn't have one. So the U.S. Marine Band graciously provided one. More broadly, the United States after 1945 stepped into the role of dominant outside power. As Britain and France's colonial grip loosened, partly due to the rise of local nationalist forces, partly due to the fact that they were exhausted. Even though they were among the victors of the Second World War, they could no longer sustain their colonial empires as easily or as painlessly, relatively speaking, as had been the case earlier. The United States stepped into what was increasingly perceived in the West as a vacuum. Now, part of this, of course, is in the context of the global war, which gets underway very soon after the end of the hostilities in Europe and Asia at the end of the Second World War. The Middle East was seen as a key strategic arena of global war. In large measure, this was because of oil. It was also its location, it's the Suez Canal, there were a number of things, but oil was clearly central to this. For the United States, it was not so much a question of needing the oil itself, because the United States was not then, and even today, is not all that dependent on oil from the Middle East directly. But control of that oil, being the dominant power where that oil is produced, gave the United States tremendous leverage over its allies in Western Europe and Japan. It gave it political leverage. The fact that it was American ships and American troops with the hand on the lever, so to speak, gave the United States leverage. As I said, the Middle East was one of the key arenas of the Cold War and would remain so now to the end of the Cold War. American policy was defined and redefined a number of times over that period, often through doctrines, right, official pronouncements of policy. The Truman Doctrine, it's sometimes forgotten, was initially very much about what was seen as the Middle East, including the insurgency in Greece, but then by extension Turkey, and so on. The Eisenhower Doctrine was very directly focused on the Middle East. And in both of these cases, the United States declared that it was prepared to intervene in this region and other regions as well. The justification was put in terms of the threat from international communism, whether direct intervention by the Soviet Union or by local proxies as they were perceived in the Soviet Union. Certainly, the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration, understood that the Red Army was not about to land in the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. And they understood at some level, or at least some officials understood, that the problems of this region and the political instability which characterized much of it in the 40s and 50s had their roots in underdevelopment, in poverty, in autocracy, and unequal distribution of resources, including oil resources. The United States very quickly adopted the position that it needed to support, despite sometimes reformist rhetoric and reformist language, it needed to support a status quo against widespread, especially in the 1950s, struggles for change. Struggles that were launched by revolutionary reformist and revolutionary nationalist forces, by left-wing movements, communist parties. For a great many people in the region, this status quo, the social and political status quo, was unjust, was perceived as unjust. The former colonial powers were, with a great deal of difficulty, expelled. But increasingly, the United States came to be seen as having taken over their role and as opposing indigenous demands for social justice, a more equitable distribution and use of the oil wealth of the region, and opposing democracy. We can cite many examples. I'm sure many of you are familiar with them. Already in the late 1940s, the very new Central Intelligence Agency is involved in trying to organize military coups in Syria, for example, often seen as a linchpin of the region, in order to make sure that friendly military regimes are in power. Perhaps the classic case is that of Iran in 1953, when a democratically elected government in Iran, in a brief window of parliamentary life, went so far as to nationalize the British-owned oil company in order to gain a greater share of the revenues to be used for Iranian national purposes. The United States and Britain cooperated first in a boycott of Iranian oil, and when that failed, as I'm sure you know, the Central Intelligence Agency organized a coup which overthrew the government of Iran and reinstalled the Shah as absolute ruler. The United States was also involved in complicated relations with the new reformist nationalist government of Nasser in Egypt in the 1950s, originally welcoming this group of young reformist officers who were also, of course, quite anti-communist, but relations soon soured as it became clear that Nasser was and his government were not interested in taking orders and towing the Cold War violent moment, which was often put in its darkest form. This was the era of John Foster Dulles, and it was very much, if you're not with us, you're against us. Something else that would have consequences for the long run is worth remembering. I had mentioned Saudi Arabia a little earlier. It's worth remembering that in the 1950s and into the 1960s, the United States often supported the Saudis in their effort to export their very conservative, very anti-communist version of Islam, because it was a useful foreign policy weapon to counter what were perceived as radical, revolutionary, secularist, pan-Arabist, nationalist forces. Now, the long-term consequences of this were perhaps a little less happy, but we see this pattern over and over again, where what seems to be short-term gains, short-term, various clever strategies end up having catastrophic and unpredicted results. Now, of course, one other key piece of the role of the United States in this region involves the question of Palestine. It's often forgotten that back in the 1950s, the United States tended to have a fairly hands-off policy with respect to Israel. It very much wanted to keep remain on good terms with its Arab allies, who were, of course, in conflict with the new state of Israel. And in the 1950s, it was actually France which developed a very close relationship with Israel, which helped Israel get its start as a nuclear weapons state. And they shared a common interest in that period because France was busy fighting in Algeria, of course, against an insurgency, a struggle for liberation, supported by Arab nationalist forces and left-wing forces across the Arab world. And this was also perceived by Israel as its enemy, this camp. So the two worked very closely together. Israel depended on French weapons in the 1950s. And of course, Israel and France and Britain collaborated in their 1956 attack on Egypt, which was thwarted ultimately by intervention by both the United States and the Soviet Union. Now, of course, this relationship changes. In the 1960s, the United States begins selling weapons to Israel, already in the Kennedy administration. It deepens in the course of the Johnson administration. And most decisively, after 1967, when Israel defeats, among other countries, the two main allies of the Soviet Union in the region, Israel comes to be seen by many, not all, but by many officials in Washington, as a key strategic ally in the global Cold War struggle. And this gets embodied in the Nixon Doctrine of 1970-1971. The United States has been defeated and is forced to withdraw from Vietnam. And so a new strategy is put in place to maintain control of what are seen to be strategic regions. In with respect to the Middle East, the United States looks for local allies who can be the local cops, since the American public will no longer tolerate direct intervention, given what's just happened in Vietnam. You need local proxies. So the Nixon Doctrine in the Middle East had three pillars. There was the Shah of Iran, armed to the teeth by the United States, who was supposed to be the sort of policeman to maintain order and thwart, again, nationalist revolutionary threats to the Arab regimes across the Persian Gulf. Saudi Arabia, which is militarily weak but has lots of cash. And the third sort of more surreptitious pillar is Israel. It doesn't look very good for Israel to intervene in these kinds of things, given the relationships between Israel and the Arab states and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but clearly that developing alliance with Israel is very much part of the same view. And this sets the stage for growing and ultimately massive U.S. aid to Israel, a very close relationship. It's often referred to as the special relationship, a unique relationship in some senses. The United States has given Israel over the decade something like $155 billion. Israel has been for many decades and remains, both on an absolute and a per capita basis, the single largest recipient of U.S. military and economic aid. And this also entailed coordination on a range of policies with Israel, opposition to Palestinian nationalism, for one. The Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestinian national cause more broadly were seen as, in the Soviet camp, in the radical Arab nationalist camp, and the United States tended to endorse the Israeli opposition to any recognition of or dealings with the PLO down to the early 1990s. Now, there are different ways to perceive this. There are people who have argued that one can attribute the close relationship between Israel and the United States to the Arab lobby, the Israel lobby. And there are debates about this. We can talk more about this. And certainly there's a question of why is it that in the post-Cold War period, the U.S.-Israel relationship has not only persisted, but in some senses deepened. And this is something people have argued about from a variety of perspectives, and we can certainly talk about it. So you have that dimension of the U.S. involvement in the Middle East, which certainly grows over time. There are, of course, setbacks. The Iranian Revolution, which whatever one thinks of the regime that resulted from it, was one of the great popular upheavals of the 20th century, produced a government which was understood by the United States, perceived by the United States as an enemy that had to be isolated and, if possible, destroyed. And you may talk about this, but this sets the stage for development of a very close relationship with Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 1980s, this effort to get rid of the Islamic Republic. And of course, there are other instances of intervention, U.S. intervention in Lebanon in 1982, which began as a project to protect Palestinian civilians left behind when the Palestinian fighters were forced out of Beirut as a consequence of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, but the United States soon gets involved in the Lebanese Civil War, and that results to U.S. Marines and French forces being targeted and ultimately the withdrawal of U.S. forces. The Gulf Crisis, of course, of 1990-91, the Gulf War, is another instance of massive involvement. Here you have the dispatch of a very large U.S. military force to the region to reverse the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait in alliance with some but not all of the Arab states. And this, of course, was military victory in the sense that the Iraqis were forced out of Kuwait. It had complicated consequences in other ways. And again, this is part of the same pattern. It certainly revealed more starkly, perhaps, than ever before, the dependence of the Saudi ruling elite on the United States. They needed the U.S. to come to their protection. And that, of course, tends to alienate certain people, among them Osama bin Laden, who had been working with the United States in the anti-Soviet movement in Afghanistan, to come to see the Saudi ruling family as puppets of the United States, and ultimately to decide to turn the guns formerly directed at the Soviets on the United States. The Clinton administration was involved in the region in the aftermath of the Oslo initiative, when the Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization initiated direct talks, direct negotiations. And there are, again, many things one can say about the Oslo process, and we can discuss this further. It's clear they didn't have the result that certainly the Palestinian national leadership had expected when it entered into them, and ultimately floundered. The Bush administration, it's worth remembering, when it first came to power, very much put the whole question of the Middle East on the back burner, and certainly the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. If you remember, George Bush campaigned in 2000 by a platform of projected nation building. This is something that Democrats did, this is something that Clinton did. He wanted But of course, after September 11th, things changed. And there came to power the direction of foreign policy in the Middle East and elsewhere came to be set by a new coalition, which had several different components. You have what you might call the ultra-imperialists, the secular ultra-imperialists, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, who basically had been in the political wilderness in the 1990s, but already at the very end of the George H.W. Bush administration, had been arguing that the United States, in the absence of the Soviet Union after the Cold War is over, must assert global hegemony by military means. That this was the opportunity for the United States to step in and use its military to crush any possible threat. And now here's their moment to try to make this happen. You have, of course, the neoconservatives, right, who have a rather different vision, but it also involves the use of American military power to remold the Middle East. And part of their agenda is to ensure that the Palestinians and the Arab states in general will accept a peace on Israel's terms, or more precisely on the terms of the Israeli right. And the last element of this is what one might call the Christianists, right? The Christian fundamentalists, who add their own particular flavor to this stew. And September 11th gives them the opportunity to assert control of U.S. foreign policy. Obviously, the campaign in Afghanistan was the first stage of this. It was relatively easy to sell, in a sense, because it was going after, in some sense, or it could be plausibly depicted as going after those who perpetrated September 11th. But in fact, Iraq was the real linchpin. There are a lot of arguments about why Iraq in particular and why at that moment. It's often depicted as a war for oil, and of course the fact that there is oil around had something to do with it. But to my mind, more important in this decision to invade Iraq was a sort of demonstration of that. Michael Ledeen, some of you may remember this name, he was one of the architects and propagandists for U.S. intervention in Central America in the 1980s. He said something in 2002 or so to the effect that every 10 years the United States needs to pick up some crappy little country and smash it against the wall just to show that we mean business. And that's putting it crudely, but quite accurately for Michael Ledeen. And I think, you know, here was an opportunity in the aftermath of September 11th where you could sell the American public on the completely fictitious connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, which I think a big chunk of the American public still seems to believe. You can demonstrate the power of the United States. You can make it clear what happens to regimes or movements which do not toe the line. You can also install a friendly regime, at least this is the vision, in a country which has a lot of oil, which also allows you to lessen your dependence on Saudi Arabia, which has proven rather problematic from the point of view of American power. And in the most grandiose visions of the neoconservatives in particular, you can reshape the region. From this new base in Iraq, you can again impose a kind of peace on the region, on the Palestinians and the Arabs, which Israel will like, and deal with a range of other problems. In ideological terms, this is very much buying into a certain vision, and the use of terrorism in particular as the catchword for this. There's a long history to this, which is worth thinking about. You may remember terrorism first surfaces as central to American foreign policy in the Reagan years. But in those days, it was international terrorism, right? It wasn't Islamic terrorism. It was international terrorism. And some of you may remember Claire Sterling's book, 1980s, which the Reagan administration touted as the last word. All these movements that the United States did not like, from Central America to the Red Brigades, to Bader Meinhof, to the African National Congress, they were all part of this international terror network, and it was all state-sponsored. If you trace the links far enough back, supposedly, you got to the Soviet Union. So it was very much seen in this Cold War context. But already you begin to see certain people trying to bring Islam into this, bring the PLO into this, and try to sell it as a key element of U.S. foreign policy. Of course, with the Cold War, you can't blame the Soviet Union. At the end of the Cold War, you can't blame the Soviet Union for terrorism anymore. And so in the 1990s, you begin to see this ideological convergence between elements of the American right, both the secularists and the Christianists, on the one hand, and elements of the Israeli right around this language of terrorism. But now it's Islamic terrorism. And this is the great threat, whether it's Iran, whether it's Islamist movements in Arab countries, whatever it might be, this is the threat. And obviously September 11th gives this a lot of emotional power and enables people, enables the Bush administration to sell this. So one could make an argument that with all that's unique, that's different, that's specific to the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and the specific conjuncture of circumstances in which it was planned and carried out, one can also see a great deal of continuity in U.S. policy with respect to the Middle East. The overarching goals, whatever the specific means, which have clearly changed from time to time, from period to period, the overarching goal is very much about maintaining control of what's perceived as a strategic region, crushing any threats, real or imagined, to that control, which means keeping in power to the extent possible friendly governments, however autocratic, however despotic, however problematic, keeping the oil flowing at low prices if possible. We see with the invasion of Iraq rather more extreme means, but they are designed to serve, at least to some extent, relatively constant goals. We can see, too, looking back over the last six decades, how this policy has led to disaster after disaster. Of course, the highest price has been paid by the peoples of the region, but as September 11th demonstrated, chickens tend to come home to roost. The current project, of course, is made worse by the vision which underpinned it of dominating this region, dominating the world. And it's been distressing, at least to me, that in the much of the criticism, certainly the mainstream criticism of Iraq, of course the word empire is not part of the language being used, it tends to be about the specifics of Iraq, right? It's similar to what was said about Vietnam in a certain sense, the wrong war at the wrong time. But the larger framework isn't part of the story. And so, of course, our job is, as I think it has been for a very long time, to put out a very different framework of understanding and a very different kind of vision of what this is about. That it's not just about Iraq, it's not just about an insane president or a criminal gang having taken over. It has its roots in something much larger. And it's not clear that if the Democrats were in power, Al Gore as president might not have invaded Iraq. But the larger policy and the kinds of alternatives which are not discussed remain very much there. The Bush administration recently announced that it was planning for the United States to sell or to transfer $63 billion of weapons to the Middle East over the next decade. And it got very little attention. Right? It didn't get a lot of criticism. You didn't hear Senator Clinton or Senator Obama saying much about it, because of course they're not unhappy with some of those transfers, at least. People may quibble about what weapons Saudi Arabia should get, but they're not arguing about what weapons Israel should get. And in general, the larger framework is all too bipartisan. We can see that this is insane at some level, perhaps at all levels, right? What the Middle East needs is schools and hospitals and jobs, needs more human rights, it needs more democracy, it definitely doesn't need more weapons. So from my point of view, it's, and especially given the profound ignorance about this part of the world, and sometimes worse than ignorance, right, the very powerful distortions and misrepresentations in the heads of a lot of people about the Middle East, about the Arab world, about the Muslim world, that's all too prevalent, and the historical amnesia from which our society suffers, it's an extremely crucial task to try to educate people in schools and outside the walls of the academy about this part of the world. It's clearly an uphill battle, but now, perhaps more than ever, we clearly have no alternative. Let me see, do I have 1 minute? Let's just say one last thing. I will wrap up here. But it also it seems to be very important to think about how we do this. And by way of example, let me just say a few words, if you will allow me a very brief rant, about how in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, much of the anti-war movement dealt with the question. There were two main camps in the anti-war movement. I'm happy we have a discussion or argument about this afterwards. One of those camps was made a point not only of not quite of remaining silent about the crimes of Saddam Hussein's regime, of the Ba'athist regime, but in effect, sort of justifying it almost. The other just refused to talk about it. And it seems to me this is very short-sighted, right? If we focus only on ourselves, right? The United States is an imperialist power, the illegitimacy of this kind of intervention, all of which is true, but failed to deal with what was the situation before 2003, the real suffering of the Iraqi people under this decades, many decades of the quasi-fascist regime, admittedly supported by the United States until 1990. We're missing something important, and I don't think we're fulfilling our duty, our responsibility in this kind of situation. It seems to me that we here in the United States have to think about not only our intervention, right, our making sure that our government doesn't engage in these kinds of enterprises, but takes very seriously an obligation to the people of Iraq and to others who were quite genuinely suffering from an intolerable situation, of course made worse, exacerbated by the sanctions regime imposed by the United States, but quite genuinely suffering under an incredibly brutal dictatorship. And the problem was, by refusing to talk about that, most of the anti-war movement, it seems to me, allowed the Bush administration to seize the high moral ground. Because here we were, bringing democracy and enlightenment to these benighted people. Right? Those people were, in fact, suffering. And it's our failure, it seems to me, that we were unable to successfully articulate politics and reach enough people with the message that, yes, the people of Iraq, they deserve democracy, they deserve human rights. Of course, we are, our country is complicit in the fact that we don't have it. But we need to figure out some new way of thinking about this, and new ways of intervening in our politics and beyond that can address this a lot more successfully than we've been able to so far. Thank you.